Okay. Welcome to Babbittville, where the roads are always smooth, the water's always warm, and the wind is always at your back. My name is Bob Babbitt, and we're brought to you every week by a new race called the 10-20, 10 miles, 20 bands, through from Del Mar up to Encinitas and back, coming up on Sunday, February 15th, cal1020.com, coresports.com, great women's clothing. Our next guest, the author of a book that, to be honest, I couldn't put down once I started. I had no idea about his background. Saw him at the races forever. Longtime buddy, Mr. Mike Rousey, author of Zero to 60 at the Speed of Life. Mikey, how the heck are you?
I'm good, Bobby. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. First of all, people see you at the races. You've been going to the races forever and ever and ever. People figure, oh, Mike Rousey, he's a guy who probably grew up, obviously a Texas guy, but probably grew up as a cross-country guy, moved into track and field, and has been living the dream forever and ever and ever. But growing up, you were not into these. You were more of a regular sport guy.
I was a golfer growing up. I played, you know, all the little sports as a young guy. And then when I was 12, got into golf and played that all through high school, college, and somewhat on a kind of a professional level. Never made it, but gave it the effort. But I thought running was a crazy man sport. Why would you go out there and run and be out of breath and sweating?
Exactly.
You know, when you could be on a golf cart.
And
so, never understood it.
Never understood it. And how good a golfer were you?
Not too shabby. I could say I had a full scholarship for 4 years. Got a free ride to school and tried to play on the tour, pro tour. But like I said, I never really got to that level. Got a card, but just never could, you know, bust through.
That's a tough way to make a living, man.
It's a very tough way to make a living. And, you know, we're talking back in the 70s when there wasn't the money as there is today. You know,
right.
if you were a sponsored athlete, meant you got a free set of clubs.
Well, yeah.
You know,
and what's
not a $10 million deal.
And what's interesting to me is you look at the difference even today between the guys who are number one on the money list and the guys last on the money list. It's like, you know, two strokes a hole.
At most, over
4 rounds. It's pretty
amazing. Yeah, it is. It's one putt makes all the difference in the world sometimes. So it was just a very cruel existence, and you know, just got tired of sleeping in the back of a car, trying to get up and, you know, play at
sure.
a level with the big boys. So decided I had to get a real job and went back home and went into business with my dad in the construction business.
I was going to say, so it was construction. Were you building homes, or this commercial real estate?
It was custom homes.
Uh-huh.
We were custom home builders. We did some small commercial stuff, but mostly it was custom homes for friends and you know, referrals. My dad had been in the business for 30 years when I went in with him, so he had quite a reputation and literally just gave me half the company.
Wow.
And it's all I'd ever known. Growing up, you know, I was on the job when I was 12, driving nails and cleaning houses. So I'd grown up with it, and it's what I knew. So I went right in with him, and we were very successful for a time.
And what people don't realize is when you're in a position like that, I mean, you're working with your dad, and you're working hard, no question about it. But at the same time, you know, you got a fair amount of, I don't know, free time is the term, but you definitely can party a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the demise of me, is that we were successful enough that we made very, very good money.
Yep.
And we were successful enough that we had our own crews that had been with us for years and knew what they were doing better than I did. So literally, all I had to do was kind of, you know, make sure that I had houses to build and customers for our people to build the houses for. And it's pretty sweet lifestyle. Got to go to the golf course every afternoon and tee it up after I had things rolling. So
when did you, and for people I've talked to who've had addiction issues and drug issues, there's never an aha moment. You go, oops, I think I've stepped over the line. It's you just go, oh, I'm still in control. I control it all.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it started small and just escalated for you.
It did, Bob. When I went through a pretty traumatic divorce when I was 30 years old and had a couple of kids from my marriage and didn't want my kids to suffer. So I literally gave my ex-wife everything I had at the time and said, you know, I'll start over and kind of move on my own direction. And the crew that I ran into, again, at the golf course were – you know, party animals, and we kind of escalated it, and now as a free guy, I could kind of do what I wanted, and started using cocaine, and literally within just a couple of weeks was pretty addicted to it. And again, good news, bad news, I had enough money that it was easy to buy, and I had a lot of friends that made it accessible to me, and so it became a pretty much a part of my lifestyle for 3 years. And I had numerous people that said to me, you know, Mike, you may be getting out of control with this. But I thought, you know, how can I be out of control? I'm running a successful business. I'm driving a Porsche 911. I'm a member of two country clubs. I play golf, you know, 5-6 days a week. How am I out of control?
Right, yeah.
I thought everything was in order until the big day came.
And the big day. So you had a, it sounds like from reading the book that you were sort of set up.
I was definitely set up, my girlfriend at the time and my dealer, both got arrested, and I was not aware of it, and they both went to their lawyers and cop pleas immediately to get deals, and both turned on me, and you know, he basically was willing to testify that he was selling me drugs, and she was testifying that, you know, I was handing them to her to use. And so it was a open and shut case, and I really didn't have any way to get out of it other than if I'd have maybe tried to lie through it. But I wanted once I got arrested, I wanted to move forward with my life and put it behind me. And I said, you know what, I did it. I made a mistake. Let me do my thing, and I'll move forward.
So when you get, it's interesting because usually you think that they're after some big fish. They're after somebody who's doing the distribution, and it sounds like the distribution guy, the guy who is selling you, they were sort of turning on a person who is a customer. It's like you weren't distributing; you were just a guy using. Not that that's a right thing to do, but it seems like it should have been the other way. It should have been you turning on the dealer.
Well, it probably should have. The problem with it was that I was very well known in my city. I'm from Abilene, Texas, and I was actually going. I had already put my name in to run for mayor.
Oh my God! Really?
Yeah, that wasn't necessarily in my book. I didn't put all that in.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, that's the reason why
you were the big
fish. My name on the list.
Yes.
You know, potential customers. It became kind of a big deal because they wanted to make an example out of me because I was the president of the Abilene Home Builders Association, and on the Coastal Affairs Council of the city council, and I was getting ready to run for mayor. So I knew everybody. Everybody knew me. I'd grown up in Abilene. I'd been there for 30-something years at the time. And so they wanted to make an example and say, look, it doesn't matter who you are, we're after you if you're using drugs.
It's interesting because I wondered about that when I read the book. I'm like, well, Mike doesn't. Is he that big a fish that they'd be going after? But you were the big fish. You were the guy. And it made sense for them. If somebody's trying to make a name for themselves, you were the guy to bring down.
Yeah, I was the front page for 7 days in a row.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So the next question, obviously, is you know, front page 7 days in a row. Your family is such an important part of that community, such an important part of the fabric of that community. Were you able to tell your folks before this stuff broke?
No. Well, actually, you know, the day I got arrested, I was actually building a house for an attorney friend who was a criminal defense attorney. And so we were halfway through building his home, and I called him from jail and said, Randy, I just got in trouble. I need you to come help me out. He said, what'd you get, a DUI or something? I'm like, no, it's a little bigger than that. And he came down and got me out, and I went straight to my parents' house. So it hadn't hit the papers or news or anything yet, but they literally knew within hours of my arrest. And I just, you know, it was one of the toughest conversations of my life, having to tell my parents that, you know, their son was a drug addict and just been charged.
Wow. And, you know, the reality of it is, and I know what a pragmatic guy you are, at the end of the day, obviously nobody wants something like this to happen, but if it hadn't happened, you think you'd still be alive?
Bob, you know, as crazy as it sounds, it literally saved my life being arrested. I was on a dead spiral.
Right.
I was 6 foot tall, weighed 125 pounds.
Oh, my God. And how much, what was your habit? How much were you spending?
About 1,000 a week.
1,000 a week back when we're talking.
Yeah, this is back in 1982 to 84.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's like $4,000 or $5,000 a week now.
That was a lot of money back then. But
yeah.
It's a lot, would have been a lot more now, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, like I say, 125 pounds. I was eating 3-4 meals a week.
A week?
A week. That's all. I didn't care anything about food. I was drinking and drugging. That's all I was doing.
Wow.
And yet, you know, somewhat operating, you know, my business still.
Yeah, you're still functioning. Because basically, it sounds like your business, to a certain degree, you had great people working for you. It was a little bit on cruise control.
Yep, exactly.
Wow.
So, it literally getting arrested and forcing me to stop using cocaine literally saved my life. So I have no real regrets about it.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I would have never wanted it to happen, would have never called for it to happen, but in hindsight, it did save my life and forced me to start over.
What's interesting to me, it seems like, especially a drug charge like that, it's not like you were driving at the time or you were putting somebody else in danger. You would assume that having dollars, you could have gotten out of this thing.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I heard my attorney was pretty expensive, and he literally did tell me at one point, he said, you know, all they have is testimony from the dealer and the, you know, your girlfriend
right.
about your drug uses, because when they arrested me, I had nothing on me. I mean, I was literally in my apartment
yeah.
when they came in and ransacked my apartment. I had no drugs on me. They had some conversations on wiretap, but, you know, again, that was basically, it was with those two people, and he said, you know, if you would stand up on the sand and say these people are lying just to save themselves, we might can get you out of it. And I said, you know, Randy, I can't lie.
Right.
It's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, I got into this thing being a scoundrel. I need to get out of it being an honest man. And I said, if it costs me going to prison, I'll do it, because I'm not going to stand on the stand and lie. I got to tell the truth.
When they took you off to prison, that first day, that first night in prison, what were you dealing with?
A lot of emotion, mostly fear.
Yeah.
Again, having been a guy who grew up in a country club setting with, a very, not a rich family, but a middle-class family that was very conservative and straight. And, you know, I grew up in a family that was very loving and kind, and all my friends were just, you know, dear, dear people. So to go from that setting to overnight going into a penitentiary was very, very fearful for me. I had no idea what to expect. And, you know, you hear all the horror stories and, you know, of gangs and
sure.
rape and everything else that can happen. And, you know, there was a lot of fear. And, again, I'm a 125-pound guy who's weak as a kitten. You know, wouldn't have been able to defend myself at any moment. But so mostly fear.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, in prison, that's the one thing you can never show.
No, you show fear, you're a dead man.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a very confusing time for me, and very frustrating, and you know, and it seems hopeless. I seem very hopeless. I'll never forget the first night laying there in my bunk that I thought, you know, here I am. I'm 33 years old. I'm bankrupt. I'll walk out of here in a few months or years or whatever the time is I'm given to serve. I'll have a felony conviction the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to want to hire me. Nobody's going to want to associate me with me. I have to leave all my old friends behind, so I'm starting over with no friends, no money, and nothing.
And you can't go back to
the rest of my life.
You can't go back to Abilene, all right?
Can't go back to Abilene, exactly.
Yeah.
And like I said, I've got no money to go anywhere else. And it was just a very fearful time, very, very tough time.
Were your parents supportive through this? I mean, it's obviously they're not going to say, hey, Mike, we understand. I'm sure there's anger. I'm sure there's disappointment.
Sure.
But did your family stand by you through this? Like, okay, Mike's gone through a tough time, but we know we can get him back?
They did. They did. They're very spiritual people,
yeah.
And they really, you know, were very loving. They never one time said anything harsh or derogatory towards me. They were sad that I'd gotten to that place, and yet believed that I could come back, because they believed in my spirit and my strength as a man. And so they were very confident. They were more confident than I was, to be honest. And yet at the same time, I said, you know, I don't want you to come see me in prison. I don't want you to see what's going on here. You know, they only came one time during the 14 months I was incarcerated, which was fine. I didn't want them to come because I didn't want my mother to see it.
No, absolutely.
And have to be associated with it. So I wanted her to just to have, you know, the memories of me as, you know, a normal, decent guy.
While you were in there for that 14 months, I mean, the positive is you found the love of your life, which is running. What were the highs and lows of being in prison after that first night where you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe everything I've done. And at the same time, you've got to move forward and you're that type of guy. Okay. I'm going to make lemonade out of this. I'm going to make something good out of this. And the nice thing is you couldn't get drugs. So you had to get clean and sober. What were the highs and lows?
You could get drugs. Oh, there was as much drugs there as there was on the street.
Wow.
Crazy as it sounds. And I won't go into all the details of how all that transpires, but believe me, there's drugs are available. I've seen guys shoot heroin using Bic pens as their syringe. It's a pretty incredible thing. I mean, when guys have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to just sit there and think about how to scheme and do things, they become very creative. They make coffee makers and, everything you can do outside, you can do inside. It's a pretty incredible situation. I didn't want to do drugs.
No.
That's what put me there. So I was, fortunately, I had the mindset that, you know what, this is something, this is not a place I want to spend my life.
Well, and when you're looking around there, you're probably thinking to yourself, if I continue on this path, this is going to be me.
Yeah, exactly.
And you didn't want that.
Yeah. I mean, I was in there with guys. One guy was involved in a bank robbery with his three cousins, and the three cousins got life without parole, and he was doing 50 years. He'd done 20, and he was 38 years old.
Oh.
He'd come in at 18, and he was 38.
And he had 30 more to wait.
And still got 30 more to go. And I thought, you know, that's the people I'm living with. This is not where I want to spend my life. This isn't the food I want to eat.
this is your new demographic.
Yeah.
That's not who you want to be. So when did running come into your life?
Literally 2 weeks to the day that I reported. I reported on January 2nd of 86, and on January the 16th of 1986, I did my very first run of my entire life around the prison yard. As I was trying to decide what I could do to get myself healthy during the time I was going to be there, I walked by the weight room and saw these big muscular guys pumping iron, and I thought, yeah, I'm not going in there. Saw guys playing handball, but I didn't, have a glove. I didn't know the rules, so I wasn't going to be embarrassed. But I saw guys just jogging or walking around the exterior of the prison yard. They'd formed a little dirt track. There was no track. It was just, a path that they had ground out. And so I went out there and asked one of the guys what the distance was, and he said it was 2.5 laps to the mile. So I thought, I'll run 2 miles and start the process of getting my health back.
Yeah.
And I couldn't make it one lap without having to stop and walk. But I kept going until I'd done the 5 laps by walking, running. And got back to my cot and thought, you know what? That's the greatest thing that I've ever done. It was so inspirational to me because I felt like I'd done something positive for the first time in years.
And you had total control over it.
I had total control over it. I could do it.
Yes. You can stop.
And over the next 14 months of incarceration, I got to where I was running anywhere from 6 to 10 miles a day.
Wow.
And, it was just my time. Being away from everyone else, being able to reflect, do something positive, and I just totally grew to love it. Started gaining weight because I started eating, more.
Yeah.
And it literally saved my life.
And when you get out, when you get out of prison, was running still going to be part of your life?
It was. In fact, I couldn't wait to go buy a real pair of running shoes.
Yeah. Hey, what were you running in?
Just some Converse.
Oh, my God.
That's all we had.
Yeah.
And, I was doing it all in Converse, Chuck Taylors.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, I didn't know anything about it. I got out and I went into a Foot Locker and bought a pair of running shoes and continued on and moved to Dallas, entered some 5Ks. My parents, you know, gave me a little bit of a foundation financially to kind of get me on the road. And not much,
yeah,
but enough to get by. So I continued, started to run, and got my first job in a running store.
Luke's Locker.
Locker in Dallas.
Love that. And that family is amazing.
Yeah. Don Lucas is like my second dad.
Yeah.
I love him with a passion because he gave me a chance when I was afraid no one else ever would.
Exactly.
And it put me around running 24 hours a day almost because I got to work in the store and got very lucky. 30 days later, after being hired, he called me into his office, and I thought he was going to let me go because of my felony conviction.
Right.
And he sat me down and said that he had never seen anybody that could sell like I could, and he wanted me to be a store manager.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe it because, again, I thought that I would never have the opportunity to make any kind of headway in life. And if I did, it was going to be years away. And here, 30 days after I'm released, I'm the manager of Luke's Locker in Dallas.
Isn't it funny when other people believe in you before you believe in you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I always find that intriguing. Yeah. That's so cool. And then running becomes your life. You end up becoming traveling around. I love, because we think about now, okay, I'm going into a store and I'm selling some merchandise and they'll invoice you through email. I mean, when you went to Alabama or wherever your territory was to go sell Mizuno's, whatever shoe brand you're selling at the time, it's a process, or Brooks, it's a process, right? You have to mail something back east. And how did that whole thing?
Yeah, well, after working for Luke's for several years, I was offered a position in a rep agency that had Brooks, which wasn't the Brooks of today.
No.
It was in their entry-level time as well back in the 90s. And they had the agency had 5 states and were offered 4 more. And so they needed a third person to come in as a partner, and I took the position. So I left Luke's, and we had 9 states, and I was basically covering Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and Iowa. 5 states.
Driving,
yeah. and all without a phone, a cell phone.
No, yeah.
I finally did get a pager that would work when I was in the city.
Yeah.
But all my orders were done on triplicate form with carbon.
Mailed.
And were snail mailed to Brooks, you know.
Yeah.
I'd leave on Monday morning and come home on Friday, being on the road all week, and then would mail in the orders I'd written for the week. And it was quite a lifestyle.
But you loved every minute of it, sleeping in your car, sleeping in stores.
My car 30 nights the first year because I couldn't afford hotels.
Yeah.
And so I'd sleep in my car in a park or something. And but I was having the time of my life, you know, running and talking running all day long.
You know, it's interesting, Mike. I'm reading through the book, and, you know, I mean, drugs, prison, get out, and then I'm going, okay, now the path of Mike Rouse, who's going to run. How many marathons have you run in your life?
253.
253 marathons. You've done Ultraman. You've done Badwater. Basically, anything that's an ultra event. So I'm looking at this book that here's the next path, and all of a sudden, there's this whole thing with the Kurds that totally came out of left field for me. I'm like, oh, wait a second. Mike did what? He basically helped get furniture for all these Kurds. And was that in Dallas?
It was. It actually started, Bob, when I first got out, right after I kind of got settled in at Luke's. I started a nonprofit working with ex-convicts because, again, I saw the need for guys coming out of prison who weren't as lucky as me, who didn't have the college degree and the family support and, the chance to get a good job like I had. They come out with 8th and 9th grade educations. Their family's given up on them. Nobody wants to hire them because they're felons and they've never done anything but steal and sell drugs. And so I started a housing program, a nonprofit, and we started housing families for 6 months and helping them get jobs and get counseling and get the kid tutors and get caught up. And it was a very fun time. And through that, I met some Kurds. This was back in 1991. And I didn't know what the word Kurd hardly meant.
Yeah, exactly.
But there were 2,000 Kurds that had been brought out of Saddam Hussein's prison camps in Iraq and brought to Dallas. and literally were dumped. They were literally taken out of the camp in the clothes they had on and were dumped in Dallas.
That's not too much of a culture shock.
Yeah, exactly. And they spoke no English. They were sheep herders, farmers, and here they are in North Dallas. And they had, you know, no skills to do anything. And we were basically giving them free apartments and food stamps and saying good luck.
Right.
And I met a man who was a Kurd who'd been here in the U.S. for about 13 years at the time. And he asked me if I could help them out. And without going into a lot of detail, I was able to furnish 52 apartments in within 24 hours of meeting these guys.
I love that part of the book because it was like, on one hand, someone saying, hey, I've got all this furniture I've got to get rid of. And at the same time, these guys are going, hey, I've got 52 apartments that, we sort of need from furniture. And that's the typical Mike Rouse going, hey, okay, wait a second. We got these guys need something. These guys have something. Yep. Let's shove everything together and everybody wins.
Exactly. Putting people together.
Exactly.
You know, because as a team, we can all do better.
Yes.
It was just an incredible time in my life. And from that, they asked me to start a school for their families that were still back in Iraq, and we were able to put that together. And I traveled in and out of Iraq numerous times in the no-fly zone of northern Iraq. And,
wow.
You know, it's just been it's been an incredible ride ever since I was released. And you know, it's really interesting, Bob, right now, is that, you know, when I go on Facebook or Twitter, there's two things that I see, or CNN or, you know, any of the news channels, there's two things that are prominent right now in our world, and that's the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge,
right,
of course, for ALS, and the Kurds and the ISIS situation.
Exactly.
And, you know, back in the 90s, I was one of the few people in the world that even knew who the Kurds were.
Right.
And was working with them, and so now they're at the forefront of our world, you know,
exactly,
world news. And then, of course, again, the Ice Bucket Challenge, my dear friend John Blaze,
yep,
who used to live here in San Diego and was a friend, contracted ALS, and we lost him in 07. And I've been doing a fundraiser for his foundation since 2007. And now this has become such a worldwide phenomenon.
Isn't that wild?
It's pretty incredible to know that I was lucky enough to have been on kind of the forefront of both of those situations.
I love that. So, Mike, when you think back of, and I look at your life, and I look at all these sort of diagonal lines going all different locations, but at the same time, the one constant since you got out of prison has been running and endurance.
Yeah.
And that's never left. That's all.
No.
You went
no.
to the dark
no.
side, shaved your legs in a bidet in Europe, and decided to get into triathlon, did Ironman, Ultraman, all that type of stuff. And you know you do a run for the troops here, for the SEALs. You do a run over in Kona. How far do you run in Kona?
I run my age, which this year I'll be doing 62 miles.
62 miles,
and
so that endurance part has been. It seems like it's been your anchor. And when you look back at everything you've accomplished, and I don't want to give away too much on the book because I want people to read the book, 0 to 60 at the Speed of Life. And Mike, where people can pick up the book, Amazon, all those type of places?
Not yet. I'm actually, this weekend, I'm putting it on Amazon and Kindle and
oh, nice,
all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it's been kind of a work in progress, it'll all be hooked up. Right now, the only way to get it is just through my website.
And what's that?
www.0to60.info.
Yeah, so zero260, the number.
Right.
Perfect.
.info.
Love that. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for taking time. Seeing you at the races in Boston, New York, Chicago, being at the Ironman, you're sort of the one constant. You're always there. You're always positive. You're always racing. And look at the lives you've changed over time. And like you say, while nobody wants to go to prison, sometimes that wake-up call can change everything.
It certainly has. And Bob, you know, I just want to say it. You didn't ask for this, obviously, but I'm going to give it anyway. You've been one of my dearest friends since I moved to San Diego back in the late 90s, and a huge supporter of mine and someone that I've always admired, because your love and support of so many people as well is worldwide, and everybody I know loves Bob Abbott, and it's a thrill for me to be on your show and to share and thank you for endorsing my book. And
I love it.
And having had a part of my life and my wife's life. Kimmy, I know, loves you and no younger than I have. And we actually met through running it as well. So
exactly.
Everything about my life is around running.
It is. And look at, and from a running perspective, you were there when Mizuno became big, right? You were right there at the ground floor when that brand became big. And you were, I know you're still doing some work with Zoot. And so you've been at the ground floor of so many innovations in the world of endurance. But to me, that stuff's great. But what you've done with your life and the lives you've changed, that's at the end of the day, that's all that really matters.
Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate that, bud.
Again, the book is 0 to 60 at the Speed of Life. The author is Mr. Mike Rouse. The book is fascinating. We, again, are brought to you by 1020. That's cal1020.com. Coming up on February 15th, 2015, Core Sports, C-O-E-U-R-Sports.com. You can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.